Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, June 9th, 2026. We begin on the first page with local business, still making music magic. Music shop owner, people keep 65-year-old store humming, by Olivia Jacobs. These days, it is rare to see local businesses open for over half a century, but the music shop in Normal still is going strong after 65 years. The reason, says Jonathan Breen, president and owner, is simple: people. He credits community support, especially from music directors, teachers, students, musicians, and his staff, for sustaining the business. The retail store at 1504 East College Avenue in Normal is a hub for sales, rental services, musical education, instrument repairs, and advocacy. The experience those customers have, they come back to see us for a reason, he said. They choose to shop with us even though most of the products we have can be purchased from any one of 1,000 different places just by pulling out your phone, he added. And yet they choose to come and patronize us based upon the fact that we provide them with a level of service and experience that they choose to support. So we're very grateful for that, and I can't say enough good things about the team, Breen added. Breen's grandparents, Tom and Bunny Wood, started the business in 1961 when they purchased what was Noonan's Music Company on Mulberry Street in Bloomington from John Noonan. It was located next to what is now the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. The store moved in 1969 to 126 East Beaufort Street in Uptown Normal. That building now houses Maggie Miley's, and it remained there for 30 years before moving in 1999 to its current location at 1540 East College Avenue, No. 4 in Normal. The Woods' son, Randy, and friend Terry Hochin joined the business in the early 1970s, and they eventually became co-owners after Tom's retirement. Randy Wood, who stayed on for 46 years, and Hochin opened Pro Sound Center as a separate location in what was College Hills Mall in Normal in 1983. That separate store later was folded into the music shop. They opened a Champaign location of the music shop in 1988, and Breen started working there. Breen said they thought he was really good at cleaning the drum kits, better than anyone else, so he stayed on. In 2016, a third location opened in Springfield after the business purchased the former Daddy-O's Music Shack. We're what the industry calls a full-line school music dealer, and so it encompasses that school, scholastic part, and the brick and mortar, said Katie Helgeson, operations manager for the music shop. That's kind of how they refer to the kind of business that we do. We do both combo and audio and band and orchestra, and then part of that is we also offer lessons, and so have a full lessons program at each of the three locations, she added. Something rare in the industry is the fact that the store still sells a wide variety of sheet music and often provides those for school district festivals, she added. The stores do some online sales, but their priority is in-person service in central Illinois, Breen said. They serve over 400 schools a week, ranging from Iowa to Indiana and from north of Interstate 80 to south of Interstate 70. They provide about 450 lessons per week in the Normal store, 150 in Champaign, and over 100 in Springfield. They sell anything from guitars, drums, keyboards, band and orchestral instruments to pianos, banjos, and harps. They even offer unusual items like didgeridoos, kazoos, cajones, and other hand percussion instruments. People are surprised by the sheer volume of stock available at the store, Breen said, noting the business is listed as both a music trades top 100 dealer and a top 100 dealer for the National Association of Music Merchants. Alisa Woods, marketing department manager for the music shop, said nearly a third of the business's footprints is the service repair department. Anything that needs to be repaired that comes in here is repaired at our business. We're not sending that back to a merchandiser or something to repair that. We have folks who are trained and highly specialized in getting those instruments up to standard, she said. And while the store isn't celebrating with an anniversary sale or a big party, Breen plans to reserve that for the more traditional 75th, it did launch a brand new logo. It partnered with Micah Vetter from No Matter Branding in downtown Bloomington and paid homage to all of the different instruments and services they offer. It's in the encompassing shape of a drum, honoring the people who came before them who were big percussionists. Additionally, they updated their tagline from, quote, specializing in service to music education since 1961 to, quote, 65 years of service. This year, they are mainly focusing on reminding the community of their history and legacy and the unusual milestone of seeing a local family-owned business survive all of these years, Breen said. Breen himself did not come from a musical background, though he's given his best shot at trying various musical instruments. He actually studied electrical engineering at the University of Illinois, but his grandfather was the first percussion major degree graduate from Illinois Wesleyan University. Breen also gained experience working at Yamaha, a musical instrument manufacturer, for 18 years. 20 years ago, there were music stores in every community, Breen said, noting there were 3 in Decatur, 4 in Danville, and several in Champaign. Today, most of those are gone, and over the years, the music shop has acquired some of those stores as affiliates. So when you think of the number of music stores that have existed in central Illinois over the last 65 years, you know, pretty cool to basically be one of the last people standing. Certainly the oldest. We're the oldest and largest in central Illinois at this point, and that's a real honor. Breen said his favorite part of the work is the magic of helping a child find the instrument that's right for them and seeing their eyes light up when they have that moment. He said they help everyone, from those who know exactly what they're looking for to those who don't even know where to start. They also just love when people come to them with a unique or odd request. Ephraim Shabani has been with the music shop for 22 years. He said he believes their students and customer-centered mission has kept him around and inspired music education in the community and surrounding areas. He said his mission as a music teacher is very similar. He said the staff leadership is supportive for faculty, especially when they need instruments, books, and resources that aren't typically available. Shabani teaches everyone from infants up to adults, primarily on piano, and offers general theory group classes. His students have gone on to win awards, and he has even spoken at the United Nations as a distinguished educator and on behalf of music education in Albania, his home country. Breen said they are very proud to have someone like him as part of their crew. I'm happy to be at the music shop. I started with Jonathan's uncle, and here we are 22 years together, said Shabani. Also on the front page is contractors paid $375,000 amid ISU strike by Drew Zimmerman. Illinois State University paid at least $375,000 to contractors it hired to supplement its workforce, while about 350 support workers were on strike for nearly a month this spring, according to billing invoices obtained by the Pantograph through the Freedom of Information Act. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Local 1110, representing building, grounds, and dining employees, went on strike on April 8th after nearly a full year of negotiations with the university for a new contract. The walkout ended May 5th with a contract settlement. The union argued the use of contractors violated state labor law, but ISU countered that contracts already were in place or were arranged through the standard procurement process. A McLean County judge denied the union's petition for a temporary restraining order. During that time, union officials identified at least 4 contractors used by the university to perform the duties of workers on the picket line. Rosalato and Company, Go Green Commercial Cleaning, BGI Services, and 4M Building Solutions. However, at least one other contractor was identified as having performed commercial cleaning services during the strike. The highest paid contractor over the course of the strike was Rosolato and Company out of Chicago, which was paid nearly $246,000 for janitorial services throughout the course of the strike, according to the billing invoices. Go Green Commercial Cleaning, which had an existing agreement with ISU, provided additional janitorial labor during the strike. The company billed ISU $65,795 for commercial cleaning services during the local 1110 strike. BGI Services was asked to perform mowing services through June 30th in an amount not to exceed $45,000, according to a purchase order. Invoices showed they were paid at least $23,000 for their services from April 12 to May 4. Renee Nessler, staff representative for AFSCME, Council 31, said ISU pays about $14.6 million annually to workers in the bargaining unit. However, the monthly amount varies depending on the time of year and whether there are any special activities occurring on campus. In the end, the union argued ISU paid more for the contractors than the union workers would have been paid. It's frustrating when ISU can pay more to outside contractors than they pay their own workers that they claim to appreciate the value of, Nessler said. Although 4M Building Solutions was identified by AFSCME Council 31 as a contractor used by ISU and an agreement for janitorial services was drawn up between the two parties in an amount not to exceed $49,000, a Freedom of Information Act request from the Pantograph uncovered no billing invoices from the company during the local 1110 strike. According to a declaration submitted by Nessler as part of a complaint from AFSCME Council 31 to cease the hiring of outside contractors, she was made aware of a social media post on April 14 from 4M Solutions about a temporary assignment starting at $17 an hour. When she called the company, a representative stated there was a five-week temporary project at ISU. Team W Inc. out of Normal, who already had a master agreement with the university to provide commercial cleaning services, also was hired to provide contingency labor for ISU's campus dining services during the strike. According to billing invoices, ISU paid $42,000 to Team W Inc. for cleaning services during the strike. Nessler said the union was initially unaware of Team W's employment. During the course of the strike, the university received numerous complaints about trash piling up in Watterson Towers because students did not have access to the building's garbage chutes. Although the hourly rates for some of these contracts were $50 or higher, ISU's spokesperson Chris Copeland said these rates incorporate multiple cost components. These rates significantly differ from and should not be interpreted as the actual wages earned by employees, Copeland said. AFSCME Council 31 argued that the use of outside contractors to replace workers on strike was in violation of the Employment of Strikebreakers Act, which stipulates that no person shall knowingly contract with a day and temporary labor service agency to provide a replacement for the employee during any period when a lockout or strike is in process. ISU's legal counsel, however, argued that if an established company with a permanent staff offers some of its employees to temporarily support another business, it doesn't automatically make that established company a day or temporary labor service agency under the law. The vendors we used were a mix of established and newer relationships for the university, Copeland said. All vendors that are utilized by the university are acquired through an established procurement process that ensures we are following the law. Local 1110's finalized contract included an immediate 3.5% wage increase and a $1,500 lump sum payment once it was ratified. Annual wage increases of 3% will follow on July 1 of each year through 2029. Next, we have a story from USA Today. Leak reveals Patriot Front growth. White supremacist group has 540 members in the United States, by Will Carlos. One of the nation's largest white supremacist groups is rapidly expanding, adding hundreds of members across 49 states in the past 2 years. Internal documents leaked to USA Today show a coordinated recruitment push fueled by step-by-step manuals and a network of fight clubs where members meet and sign up new recruits. The files, provided by a source inside Patriot Front, offer a rare look at the group's inner workings as it accelerates its growth. Known for its highly choreographed rallies, rows of identically dressed men in blue shirts, chinos, and white face coverings carrying American flags, the group has used disciplined optics to amplify its reach and visibility nationwide. A USA Today analysis of the group's 72-page member roster and other obtained documents revealed, 1, the group has more than 540 members covering every state except Hawaii as of early 2026. 2, it has roughly doubled in size every year since its founding in 2018 and gained more than half of its new members in surges during the past 2 years. 3, it is affiliated with dozens of active clubs where young white supremacists are known to train in mixed martial arts and congregate. And 4, the group closely manages its propaganda and marketing with several guides that members must strictly adhere to. In an internal communication provided by the leak, the Texas-headquartered group's leader, 27-year-old Thomas Rousseau, urges his members to get more involved, stay fit, and continue their campaign of white supremacist propaganda. He calls for 600 members by July 4, 2026. This is a hand-picked band of dedicated men that far exceeds any of our domestic contemporaries, Rousseau writes. These teams need dedicated members, men willing to work for the cause and not just fight for it. The secretive organization portrays itself as merely patriotic, fighting for traditional American values. But the documents obtained by USA Today provide fresh evidence of the group's intentions and future direction, quote, working to secure a future for white children, close quote, as one applicant to the group wrote. Quote, white nationalists tired of watching my country be raped and pillaged by foreign invaders, close quote, wrote another Patriot Front hopeful as he applied for membership. USA Today is not identifying the source of the documents out of safety concerns. Patriot Front did not respond to a request for comment. The group publicly eschews violence, and the documents provided to USA Today include instructions to members to specifically avoid violent or aggressive confrontations. Quote, suggestion or conduct which may infer, encourage, or advocate for members to become aggressively violent themselves or encourage it in others is prohibited, one document read. Dozens of members of Patriot Front were charged with conspiracy to riot in 2022 after being arrested en route to protest a pride parade in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. 5 were eventually convicted. Other members have been charged with vandalism for defacing a pride mural in Olympia, Washington, and at Richmond, Virginia Memorial commemorating Arthur Ashe, the first black man to win singles tennis titles at Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, and the Australian Open. Quote, Patriot Front is the most active white nationalist group we track, said Jeff Tischhauser, a senior research analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center, who has been researching the organization since its inception. Quote, what you have are internal documents to a very secretive white nationalist group, and any time we get some documentation on what's going on inside the group, the better we can inform our communities about what's going on inside this hate group. One of the documents provided to USA Today is a list of active clubs across the country affiliated with Patriot Front. There are at least 23 in total, spread across 32 states, since some clubs are listed for more than one state. The clubs are essentially small groups of young men who organize online to come together in real-life meetups, either at gyms or at outside locations where they train and spar, practice mixed martial arts, and engage in other outdoor activities. Members of the group participate in several demonstrations a year, usually attracting at least 100 participants. No one has rebranded themselves as successfully as Patriot Front, said Carla Hill, a vice president of research and investigations at the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism, which monitors the group. They're very good at optics. They plan everything ahead. They dress alike. They're color coordinated. It's all planned. You may well have seen some of Patriot Front's propaganda stickers, flyers, or banners in your neighborhood without even realizing it. The propaganda isn't far from what you might see from brands that emphasize American patriotism. Using a set palette of reds, whites, and blues and incorporating Patriot Front's logos, flyers often appeal using patriotic rhetoric like America First alongside images of white men. Other examples veer closer to Patriot Front's true white supremacist ideology, using slogans like Reclaim America and Not Stolen, Conquered. The group is also overtly anti-Semitic, with members bearing banners at events that read, No Zionists in Government. They're trying to attract the widest possible audience, so they put out some messaging that is patriotic in its orientation, said J.M. Berger, a researcher, author, and academic who co-authored a seminal 2020 study on Patriot Front's propaganda efforts. They're trying to capture people who, if you just said, hey, do you want to join the Nazi party, would say, no. Our mission is a hard reset on the nation we see today, a return to the traditions and values of our forefathers, reads Patriot Front's website. While the word white doesn't appear in the manifesto, the leaked messages, along with years of research on Rousseau and several other members of the group, have led experts across the board to establish Patriot Front's goals. Also from USA Today, we have the price of free speech. Settlements pile up after shooting death of activist Charlie Kirk by Drew Pittock and Brianna J. Frank. Settlements totaling more than $1.5 million have been reached with people who lost their jobs over social media posts that were critical of prominent conservative activist Charlie Kirk in the wake of his assassination. The free speech cases in Florida, Tennessee, and Indiana highlight a growing debate about the First Amendment, political discourse, and social media. It's not surprising to see this flurry of settlements, Aaron Turr, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expressions Director of Public Advocacy, told USA Today. I think the size and frequency of these settlements shows that violating the First Amendment is expensive. USA Today reported a little more than 2 weeks after Kirk was killed that at least 50 people had lost their jobs in the education sector alone. A Reuters investigation was also found that 600 people were fired across the private sector for posts they shared about Kirk. Here are a few of the most recent settlements. Ball State University in Indiana agreed to pay $225,000 to its former health director, Suzanne Swirk, after she was fired for making a critical social media post following Kirk's assassination, according to reporting from Indy Star, part of the USA Today network. Swirk and the American Civil Liberties Union sued Ball State President Jeffrey Mearns last September in federal court, claiming her firing violated her First Amendment rights. I never regretted the post, Swirk told Indy Star. I have just as much right to say that as anyone else, and I don't regret it because I still believe the things that I wrote. Joshua Bleich, one of the ACLU attorneys who worked on her case, added, if government officials aren't being sufficiently respectful of somebody's First Amendment rights, there's going to be some kind of legal cost. As part of the settlement, Ball State did not admit wrongdoing. In an email sent to university leadership after the settlement was agreed, Mearns stood by his decision to fire Swirk. He said her post resulted in threats to withhold donations and enrollment, and that it was extraordinarily damaging to the university's reputation and exceptionally disruptive to our mission and to our people. Florida will pay nearly $500,000 to Brittany Brown to settle a free speech lawsuit after she was fired from her state job for a social media post criticizing Kirk after he was killed. Brown, a biologist who worked for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, filed a lawsuit after she was fired just days after he was slain. She reposted another account's post to her private Instagram story. The post that got her in hot water read, "The whales are deeply saddened to learn of the shooting of Charlie Kirk. Ha ha, just kidding. They care exactly as much as Charlie Kirk cared about children being shot in their classrooms, which is to say, not at all." At the time, the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission said Brown's post made light of Kirk's killing. "We have a zero-tolerance policy toward the promotion of violence and hate, and we will not stand for such behavior," the agency said in a post on social media on September 15th. An agency spokesperson declined to comment on the settlement, which includes a $485,000 payout to Brown. Gary Ettinger, an attorney representing her, said the case is the result of Brown's refusal to accept that the government gets to decide which opinions its employees are allowed to hold. "These concerning practices underscore the extent to which political pressure from Tallahassee is influencing our state agencies," Brown said in a statement. "FWC employees deserve better, and so do Floridians." A settlement was reached in the case of Larry Bouchard, a former police officer in Tennessee who was arrested September 22nd and charged with making threats of mass violence after posting a photo of a quote from President Donald Trump in the Facebook comments of a local community group page. He was held on $2 million bail for more than a month. The charge was dismissed in late October, and Bouchard subsequently filed a lawsuit against Perry County Sheriff Nick Weems and the investigator who secured the arrest warrant. His incarceration caused him to lose his job in medical transportation and to miss the anniversary and birth of his grandchild, according to his lawyers. On May 20th, an $850,000 settlement was reached in the case in exchange for dismissing the complaint, according to a news release by TERS organization FIRE, which represented Bouchard. The settlement does not include admission of wrongdoing on the defendant's behalf. "I am pleased my First Amendment rights have been vindicated," Bouchard said in the statement. "The people's freedom to participate in civil discourse is crucial to a healthy democracy. I'm looking forward to moving on and spending time with my family." David Keating, president of the Institute for Free Speech, said the firings and subsequent settlements can perhaps be a teachable moment, leading employers to find a way to publicly distance themselves from employees' controversial speech while defending their First Amendment rights to make such remarks. He said insurance companies often pay for settlements involving government actors, and that he hopes the Kirk-related lawsuits will lead to more constitutional scrutiny when they write policies for these clients. "Simply asking those questions might help us gain knowledge on the local level on the First Amendment, which unfortunately seems to be sorely lacking." Speaking more broadly, Keating also referenced Republicans' free speech platform in the 2024 election and noted that many of the Kirk-related speech lawsuits involved public officials in GOP-controlled states. Kirk himself advocated for free speech, Keating said, and Erica Kirk proclaimed that she had forgiven her husband's assassin at his memorial service in Arizona. "If she can find the ability to do that, then certainly an elected official can pattern that behavior." And with that, I conclude the reading of part one of the Pantograph for Tuesday, June 9th, 2026. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with part two.